May it please the court. Counsel. If the right to a fair trial, as guaranteed by our Missouri Constitution, serves as the foundation of our civil justice system, then a fair and proper voir dire is the very lifeblood, heart, and soul of that right to a fair trial by jury. Mr. Shirky expressed multiple biases under oath. At no time did he ever recant these. At no time did they dissipate. At no time was he rehabilitated on any specific bias. There was no independent inquiry by the court, despite the court's duty to do so as required by the case law. And therefore, he should have been excused under Section 494, 470.1. As many of the other jurors were. Public policy prudence dictates that the better course is to excuse a juror under those circumstances. Reading through the transcript, Mr. Shirky came at the end or near the end of a long line of granted challenges for cause, getting near not even having enough of a panel. But it's better to call out for more jurors. Finish the trial, even if it's delayed a day, as much of a hardship as that often is, than it is to complete a 2-week trial and take all parties through the appellate process. Public policy definitely favors excusing the juror under those circumstances.
Are you suggesting that the test needs to be, I thought that the test was that he could put it, a juror has to put aside what his own beliefs are and follow the evidence and the laws given by the judge. But are you suggesting that when he expresses a point of view on a particular thing, that that has to be inquired of directly, whether he can set aside his belief in that jury's verdicts are runaway or something and just judge the law and facts on this case?
Yes, Your Honor, and the cases we cited in the brief, as good examples, I call it AGC, the Acetylene Gas case, Brown, several others, are a challenge for rehabilitation on that point. If somebody says, I've got a problem of this nature, and then you come back and just simply say, I can be fair, that doesn't pass muster. And it also requires a distinction between the subpart 1 and subpart 2 analysis. They are different.
As I understood your argument also, it was that even if you have a more general rehabilitation process, here to simply ask, can you be fair, which is kind of judging the ultimate question yourself, as opposed to, was he ever asked, can you put aside your personal beliefs about the size of verdicts and follow the law and the evidence as given to you?
No, Your Honor, he was not, and in fact, turning to the transcript, the two jurors who were questioned by defense counsel immediately before Mr. Shirky were, in fact, asked that line. Mr. Bryant is one that comes to my mind offhand, and he was asked, could you set this aside? And it was that direct one-on-one, as Judge Wolf refers to, on that bias. And he was asked, could you set this aside? And he says, no, I don't think I can. And I think that was Mr. Hunt's questioning, transcript page 300 for convenience. Mr. Shirky was never asked that. He was asked much more general and leading questions. Can you be fair? Well, fairness, first off, it's not in the statute. I know that's the general concept we're looking for. But when you analyze what was done, someone who, under oath, voluntarily, in response to my open-ended question, how do you feel about that? I probably would be biased in favor of the doctors. Based upon that bias and filtered through that bias, he's been asked, but can you be fair? Well, sure, fair according to a biased person. That's circular and defies logic, actually.
Keeping in mind some of the strong statements that Mr. Shirky made initially on voir dire, is there anything that could have been done to rehabilitate him? I know that you indicated the question, can you put aside your beliefs? Would that have been enough, or could there have been anything done to rehabilitate him, considering the strong statements he initially made?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that, of course, is the job of effectively cross-examination. The defense for Dyer, I mean, the tables can be turned depending on the circumstances. But this is testimony, and he has testified to that bias, and he's subject to effective cross-examination. Again, under point one, the opinions which may influence his judgment in this case, and I want to keep on your answer, but this ties in directly, because what happened is it was basically a point one impeachment of his qualification on my breath, and then the defense turns around and conducts a point two rehabilitation. Can you follow the instructions? He never said my biases prevent me from following the instructions. That was not my impeachment of his qualifications to serve on direct, if you will, of the voir dire. He said, I have these biases, and it was clear. He led off following his son as I transitioned and segued from her. Her final problem was she would favor the defense experts. And I asked, who else feels that way? Mr. Shirky raised his hand, said, yes, I feel that way. And then we went on to the bias in favor of the doctors, the verdicts, et cetera.
Judge Russell characterizes his statements as being strong statements of bias, but my recollection is that his testimony was his statements were very different than Ms. Sun's, that he was probably, and in light of that, is that a significant difference that he didn't, in reading it, he may not have made as strong of statements of bias, and that the trial court's there, the trial court sees his demeanor. In fact, I think there was a comment on it when the judge was ruling on your strike. And so what's the significance that in fact his own statements and his own behavior may have indicated it wasn't a strong bias?
Two-part answer. You are correct that Mr. Shirky's expressions, his opinions that would influence his judgment, may not have been as deeply entrenched or firmly expressed as Ms. Sun's. They were significant enough to pass the bar. And in fact, again, we're all strapped with reading the cold record, as we know. We weren't there. But, as I pointed out in our brief, his expressions live in front of everyone were not lost on Mr. Conrad, who was one of the most talkative jurors, you always get one of those, three separate times in mulling over and wrestling with Mr. Convery's own biases, he referred to Mr. Shirky by name. When Mr. Hunt, defense counsel, asked, he said, I see here in my notes you would favor the doctors. When I challenged him, an entire start-to-finish challenge that's less than one page by 19 lines, the judge himself said, yes, I remembered him. He was the one biased in favor of the doctors. It was strong. And we must take the voir dire as a whole, and we cannot ignore the fact that other jurors, defense counsel, and the judge independently recognized the strength and depth of that bias.
In analyzing the issue, I was interested in your characterization of cases as falling into different categories. Is that your own analysis of the different cases, and does the law support different standards based on different responses or the nature of the responses?
Working backwards, I don't believe the law sets forth different standards, so long as you're distinguishing point one and point two, because that's important. Yes, that is my own categorization. When I began reading dozens of cases, they looked like they were all over the place, and I couldn't reconcile one holding with another, various facts, various parameters. They began, when I started cataloging and saying, well, here's independent inquiry, here is not, there's contrasting holdings, why? Here's an unequivocal expression followed by a flip-flop. Here's rehabilitation, no rehabilitation, and such. When I analyzed them in that fashion, both on the facts and comparing them to law, then I did see a reasonably consistent, rational grouping of those cases that explained why those holdings were appropriate.
And you characterize his statements as showing bias on the facts of this case as opposed to just general bias?
Yes, ma'am. The general bias point to, I can't judge people, moral, ethic, religious, whatever. I can't place a dollar value on an issue. That may well affect many different cases. Case specific, the biases testified to by Mr. Shirky would not apply in a banking contract case. This type of case, these types of parties were specific to the foundation of his opinions that would influence his judgment.
And if I understand, basically you're proposing that where a veneer person expresses a bias, but particularly, say, in this kind of situation where he said, probably I couldn't set this aside, or probably I would be biased in favor of doctors, that if rehabilitation does not, attempts at rehabilitation are not complete or don't completely get a, leave it a little bit unclear whether the person could set aside their biases, the court has an independent duty to inquire,
yes,
to clarify that or to help them judge credibility, or how would we apply such a rule if we were to adopt it?
Well, let me lean back to the
kind of ties in with that question.
Category. Yeah. I believe, to the best that cases can be pigeonholed, which is always has an inherent difficulty, that this is a Category 2 case. If not, it would be a 3.
And since the categories I know are very firmly fixed in your mind, but perhaps less in ours, if you could be a little more explanatory in your description.
I've got 1 second.
Go ahead.
Category 2 is the veneer person unequivocally expresses significant factually supported biases, and there is neither any attempt to rehabilitate by countering the specific biases other than by inviting the veneer person to assess their own bias. And there's, you rely upon the veneer person to self-assess, and there's no independent.
So basically you're saying if opposing counsel didn't engage in specific rehabilitation as to the specific biases, then it's incumbent on the court to do so if it's going to find the person can sit.
Yes, the cases say if there's an ambiguity, mm-hmm. and if this is not a Category 2 case, it would fall into a 3A, or 3B, where there was not any independent inquiry, because if the inquiry doesn't go head-to-head with the bias, it's unaddressed. You can't ask somebody if they can set it aside if you don't address it.
And there are cases that you think make that distinction, our prior cases?
Yes, ma'am. They're referred in the argument portion,
yeah,
of our brief.
And the difference between Category 2 and 3 is whether the expression of bias was unequivocal or equivocal. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. 3, and then it's A and B, whether there's independent inquiry or not. And the cases we've categorized in that fashion are describing the three and why they fall into those two different groups.
I want to say I appreciate your analysis and attempt to analyze these cases. If you could then, in a future case, analyze proximate cause and make sense out of that, that would be great.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much. Please support Camp High here for responding, Dr. Stephen Morrison. There will be no appearance for Dr. Buckner. The issues are the same. It is a privilege to be before this honorable court. We pick juries all the time, and we always start out with ordinary people giving various opinions on what they think about the initial proposition. And I would suggest it's not where you start out in Voir dire, it's where you end up. And so Mr. Shirky knew that the plaintiff was sitting in a wheelchair missing one leg. He knew the defendants were doctors, and he was told this was a medical malpractice case. That's all he knew. And so he was then asked about opinions, and he says the comment, I'd start out in favor of the doctors. Well, what's wrong with that, if anything? There's cases where I can talk about them in a minute. No one starts out saying, I think murder's a fine thing. I don't have a problem with murder.
So a lot of people would say, well, yeah, I don't really like malpractice. Or if a guy's missing a leg or had a complication, I start out thinking maybe he just had a complication of the disease. I start out for the doctor. That's normal. Nothing wrong with a normal person being on a jury. Now, when Mr. Shirky was asked in detail, and it took all day to get from Mr. Ranson through what little I know to ask to Mr. Hunt, but it took all day. And when this unfolded, Mr. Shirky finally said, in response to being asked specifically what the jury instructions would ask him to do, if he was on the jury and he got to determine if there was negligence as defined in MAI and award money, could he do that? He says, absolutely. No equivocation. No doubt in his mind. And then, I believe, Judge Wolf, you asked about personal beliefs and setting aside the size of the verdict. Mr. Shirky actually made the comment about McDonald's, which everyone still does. I guess people are never going to forget that case. But
they've had a lot of help.
Pardon?
They've had a lot of help.
That's exactly right. But Mr. Ranson, on page 112, himself asked Mr. Shirky, by Mr. Ranson, there's no allegation of spilling coffee. McDonald's isn't here. Can you put that completely out of your mind? His answer is yes. Period. Next question. Okay, you kind of hesitated. Answer by Mr. Shirky. No. I can put that out of my mind. Question. In the context of signing a verdict for a large amount of money, would you, and you haven't heard the evidence, you don't know anything about the claims, the mere fact that it's a large amount of money, is there a number at which you'd say, I won't sign that verdict regardless of the evidence? Answer by Mr. Shirky. No. So, we have a specific inquiry on the personal beliefs of Mr. Shirky, and it's taken care of. It's unequivocal. Now, this issue, maybe we all know this. Does the court have to do the inquiry to take out equivocation, or can counsel do it? Clearly, counsel can do it.
No, there are times that this court has said that the court had an independent duty to inquire where it was not clear from the record. Counsel can, but where it's not clear from the inquiries of counsel, we do have cases saying the court must act.
I didn't state that very well. Okay. Does the court have to do it if counsel didn't? Absolutely. If it's not clear from the record after counsel is done, then the court should inquire. And what I meant to say is the court doesn't have to do it independently if the court thinks it's clear after counsel inquiry. And here I think Judge Sweeney, by his comment, did that.
Did you ask if he could set aside his bias? He indicated a bias in favor of doctors. Could he set that aside and follow the court's instructions?
The few questions I asked him was specifically what the instruction would be. Specifically gave that to him if he could find for that. And the first question to him included a finding for the plaintiff and determining how much the plaintiff would get if it's fair and reasonable. And he said, yes, I could do that. And then Mr. Hunt asked him specifically about determining the damages. Could he determine damages that are fair and reasonable? And Mr. Shirky's response out of his own mouth was, those are good words, fair and reasonable. He said, yes, I can do that. And so, this category business is new to me, too. And it's not the law. And we do have two sections of our statute at issue here. And I think the appellate wants to make this a paragraph one case that Mr. Shirky knew something about this case, which is clearly not. Our Southern District opinion clearly says it's not a paragraph one, it's under paragraph two, which is simply disqualifies persons whose opinions or beliefs preclude them from following the law. Period. Mr. Shirky is an ordinary, average, intelligent, informed citizen of Greene County, Missouri, of age and qualified as a juror, and he gets to serve unless his opinions and beliefs preclude him from following the law. Period. And he was asked questions by defense counsel specifically if he could follow the law and given what the law would be in the case, and there was no equivocation on his part. I think that answers the inquiry in this case.
Now, clarify for me what his stated biases were. And I know that it was Ms. Sun who was talking about doctors, and I'm trying to make sure I don't confuse the two. She was talking about that sometimes you just get a bad result. And he was talking about the amounts of verdicts as opposed to Or did he also indicate he was concerned about a bias for doctors?
He was not like Mrs. Sons. He did say at one point that he would start out in favor or bias towards the doctors. That was on the inquiry. And again, it's hard to put all this together when this took a day, but that was on the inquiry about there's a man here that's injured. This is a medical malpractice case. Based on that alone, how would you start out? He did express concern about excess and large verdicts in this country. The McDonald's verdict was brought up again, but then those were specifically addressed with him, in part by Mr. Ransom. He said, no, I can put all that aside. I just think generally in this country, verdicts are out of hand. Now, part of this, of course, is prompted by the questions he's asked. He was asked that question by appellant's counsel. How many people think that verdicts in this country are too big? Well, of course, 90% of the hands in the room lie. And then those people were questioned about what they thought. That's normal. That's normal. In my view, Mr. Shirky is a normal man qualified to serve on a jury unless paragraph 2 of our statute precludes him because he can't follow the law. Period. Now, that's been addressed in several cases. We've cited them. I probably won't have time to go through all of them. But in the Rogers versus BG Transit case that we've cited in the brief, the veneerman had the same issue about damages. I don't know about these amounts of money. I'm on page 156 of that opinion. He said, you just have to convince me that you're entitled to it. And leaving him on that jury was supported. And, of course, there's nothing wrong with that because that's the law. And Mr. Shirky made some of the same comments. Plaintiff has the burden to prove what their damages are, and at one point, Mr. Shirky says, you just have to convince me. Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Does the plaintiff have to prove a burden, or does the plaintiff have to prove prejudice?
By leaving Mr. Shirky on there?
Yes.
Well, I think they do. I think they do.
How could you ever prove prejudice? You could never know what went on in the jury room, so you would never have a successful challenge on appeal.
Yeah, I think it'd be very hard to prove. I mean, I think the plaintiffs would have to have prejudice. How they prove it, I have no idea.
Has any case ever, other than the Court of Appeals here, ever required proof of prejudice in addition to proving that a biased juror served? Isn't that in itself proof that you have a non-qualified juror is itself prejudicial?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think the law ought to require prejudice. How you would show it, I don't know. And, of course, the cases haven't required that. But the other case that's significant to us is the Ham case, which came out of the Western District. And I know you're familiar with it, but it was a murder case. The defendant had been drinking, was drunk, beat, stabbed, and killed a person. One lady that was allowed to serve, very troubled by drinking. It almost reads like more troubled by drinking than murder, but very troubled by the drinking. And in the opinion, Justice Dibb, I believe you wrote it, found that her answers seemed to reflect not a bias against the defendant, but simply a dislike of certain conduct, such as getting drunk and beating and stabbing another person. Such feelings are natural, and if they will not prevent a person from fairly judging a case in accordance with the evidence and the court's instructions, they should not preclude his prospective juror from sitting on the jury. In my view, that's exactly what we have with Mr. Church. He has opinions about doctors, about malpractice, generally thinks that doctors do a good job, that they're trying to help people. There's nothing wrong with that. And when he was specifically asked about this case, damages, could he put aside McDonald's? He answered the question, yes, I absolutely can. When he was given the shortened version of the verdict director instruction in this case, he said absolutely he could follow that. So my view is qualified.
So what if he has said, I don't like lawyers? Let's say it's a legal malpractice. I don't like lawyers. Of course, you could say that lawyers don't produce the same outcomes as doctors, probably. But I'm just saying, if you say I don't like lawyers, and but I'll follow the instructions. But it's a lawyer malpractice case, and that's still a factor in how they're going to look at the instructions.
It's still a factor, but we hear that all the time. We hear it in medical malpractice cases, they don't like the lawyers, but if you disqualified all those people just because they said that, we'd never have a jury. And so I think the general thought I don't like lawyers. I don't like malpractice cases. I don't like murder. I mean, we don't expect anyone to come in and say murder's okay.
I don't think that's a hard one. I don't think many jurors would say, I think murder's okay. But as far as lawyers, following what your opponent said, I'm not saying buy into that, but I'm just saying following what your opponent says, if someone says, I don't like lawyers, I don't like African-Americans, or I don't like women, instead of saying, can you be fair, which is general, would you think there should be a higher standard saying, well, there's a lawyer here, or there's an African-American or a woman, can you directly get to that point and say, can you put aside your biases and decide this case?
Absolutely, and I think that person, if they answered that to the satisfaction of the court, they remain on the jury, even though they say, I can't stand lawyers. I think they do a horrible thing for society and they charge too much, etc. That person would still be qualified or not disqualified under paragraph 2 of the statute. I think so.
And did you need to more specifically say, can you set aside your bias in favor of doctors and decide and against award malpractice verdicts in general and consider the evidence in this case?
Yes, and I believe that was done. That was done by Mr. Hunt at one point, and then when I can't cite you the page yet, but it's in the transcript. It was done by Mr. Hunt, and it was done again when he was given again the specific question. In this case, if you get to decide if these doctors were negligent, and if you get to decide they were, and you get to decide how much the plan is awarded, can you do that? And he unequivocally said, yes, I can. And it was put to him the other way. You believe there was no negligence. Mm-hmm. No negligence. Can you find in favor of the doctor? He said, yes, I can. Unequivocally, each one. So I believe that is okay. Where I believe it was done.
Okay.
What your opponent argues that this case is a paragraph 1 case, a subsection 1 case, because it was a bias about a general issue that's going to be in this case. What's the case law that supports that it needs to be a bias about specific facts of the case or about that case versus it's a bias on the subject of the case?
There's lots of cases. We've cited in the brief. I've got some here. A lot of criminal cases where, for example, a veneer person knew a witness, was related to the prosecutor, had read the facts of the case in the newspaper, things specific to that case for a witness that would be in that case for conduct in that case. And I think those cases are very clear, and there's a whole lot of them.
Is it just because those are the facts that support that, or has there been an analysis in the case that's the limitation of subsection 1?
I believe it's those cases, comparing it to the language of the statute, that they knew something, you know, material to that case.
And of course, as Judge Breckenridge pointed out, it, having been a trial judge, it's a high standard to reverse the trial judge, because the trial judge gets a chance to see the demeanor and observe the witness or the juror as they testify.
I believe that's exactly right, and I think, of course, I'm biased because I think it's all in order. But if we look at what Judge Sweeney did, Judge Sweeney didn't sit there and refuse to strike all those people who had positive comments for doctors. Didn't occur. He struck those people that he thought had that bias that would not allow them to be qualified jurors under paragraph 2. And he assessed Mr. Shirky in a different way, which really only he could do because of being here. And he addressed that in the record.
Were there any veneer persons left after the jury was chosen and the alternates were chosen?
There were a few, but there weren't very many.
And there was a limit on the number of strikes. There were no strikes of the alternates, is that right?
I don't remember that was the case. Is that the case?
Okay. Did you end up using alternates at all?
We did not. Okay. They were excused, I mean, from the jury.
But you got a chance, both parties had a chance to exercise all your peremptory challenges.
Absolutely.
Okay.
No other questions, then I think that's all I have.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Now, you're concerned about this particular juror, but the judge did strike some, he didn't strike others, so the judge is exercising some of his discretion in deciding who is biased and who isn't by their demeanor, their expressions, the way they answer the questions.
We also have to look at what Judge Sweeney said. He said he believed Mr. Shirky recanted. He never recanted. His opinions never dissipated. He never said that they would change.
Why aren't the answers referred to by opposing counsel sufficiently specific to rehabilitate him?
we're not getting the whole story in the context of the rehabilitation. In that context, Mr. Hyde, with all due respect, said that the instruction, I think he said, he was given a shortened version of the verdict record. He was not. Mr. Hyde's examination is very short, two questions, page 277. He simply says, can you sign a plaintiff's verdict? Yes. Can you sign a defense verdict? Yes. Not any conditions or premise. If the verdict record tells you, the jury instruction tells you, it's such and so. There are cases out there about the burden proof or adverse inference, for example. It's not necessarily enough to say, well, if somebody doesn't testify, can you get over that adverse inference? Most lay people don't even know what an adverse inference is.
But what about the defendant's questions of Mr. Sharkey when he said, if you believe there's negligence and there's damages, then you get to decide that and how much they are, can you do that? And he said yes. And then defense counsel also said, and if you believe there's no negligence, can you also find in favor of the doctors? And the veneer panel person said yes.
Good question. The focus needs to be that it's in the context of his previously announced under oath biases that would affect his judgment. No one is saying, can you set those aside and sever that influence? That's what point one addresses. Whether those opinions, we all have opinions. You're not going to get anybody to come into court without an opinion. That's why we have voir dire, recognizing that. And the wisdom of the legislature in recognizing there are case-specific biases and there's the big picture general biases. And by the way, I don't recall the case Mr. Hyde referred to, but it relies on a statute 546.150 when he talks about the criminal case and knowing witnesses and hearing it in the paper. That statute has since been repeated. That case is clearly distinguishable from the facts we have here. But the point is this meeting the issue head-to-head, joining essentially if a prima facie disqualification has occurred, merely coming back and saying, can you be fair? Doesn't get it.
Can you find against the doctor? I mean, can you find against the doctors more specific than can you be fair?
I'm sorry?
Can you find against the doctor, negligence against the doctor, that's more specific than being just fair?
It still leaves it in a vacuum. Find against the doctor based upon what? Because he murdered the patient? You know, just simply saying, can you find one? Sure. You're asking a juror to give sworn, avowed pledge of allegiance to follow an instruction they've never heard. Most lawyers have trouble understanding instructions.
We have one more question, I believe.
Yeah, counsel, if I'm understanding your argument, the trial judge, if there's an expression of case-specific bias, the trial judge or the opposing attorney would almost have to do a converse. You know, in instructions, we talk about them as a converse, but it's a converse in terms of voir dire. If you express that, then they have to come back. You're arguing that you really have to come back and say, you've indicated this bias. Now, despite this bias, can you be fair? And negate each of the bias statements.
If they are, when you say each, mm-hmm. I don't want to throw an overly broad net. I don't like
it. If they're case-specific, case-specific bias.
And significant that, according to the statute, is perceived by others there that it may influence their judgment on that case, that meets the requirement of the statute, not just simply saying, pardon me, can you be fair? If that were the standard, voir dire would be a single question, over at 905, you swear in the first 12 and move down the road. That's the standard advocated by the defense.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted.